Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program James Lee Burke. Hello, Jim.
Hey, Vic. Thank you for having me on your show again.
Jim, this has become sort of a ritual for me. Every summer, I try to connect with you because it seems like you put out a book usually in the summertime, and you just put out a new one. In fact, I think today's the official publication date. It's called Wayfaring Stranger.
Yes, today is Pub Date, and it's very exciting. Of course, you know, it's the book that I know this book is not only the best thing I've written, it's far beyond anything I've written before.
And it's also very different because this isn't a Dave Robichaux book. It's not a Hackberry Holland book. It's not a Billy Bob Holland book. Well, it's sort of a Hackberry Holland book, but only in a very peripheral way. Can you explain the connection? There is a guy in this book named Hackberry Holland, but he's not the one that we think of.
We meet the elder Hackberry Holland. Again, I've been writing about the Holland family, of course, for many years. The character you mentioned is Hackberry Holland, the former Texas Ranger and lawman who put John Wesley Hardin in jail. But the story begins in 1934, and the story is narrated by his grandson, Weldon Holland. The story is really about what Gore Vidal called the Golden Age following World War II in the early 1950s. But it's a bit more complicated than that. The era in which we live now is one that we can only understand, in my opinion, if we understand it's our past, the origins of the present. And the new American empire was created in the post-war years. For good or bad, that's the era we entered. And T.E. Lawrence said it back in 1915 in his book, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom. The issue in 1914 in the Great War was oil and wheat, he said. And it's the issue today. And we deny that. We're kind of walking around in the same desert the French and the British did, but I think we have a way of blindfolding ourselves to the history of neocolonialism and the role which we either accepted or we imposed upon ourselves. But it's a story begins in 1934 with Bonnie and Clyde. And I dedicated the book to my cousin, Weldon Benbow Buddy Millett, who was just a wonderful guy. And Weldon, my cousin, and Weldon, the narrator of the book, both went to the Battle of the Bulge. And both of them went all the way to the Elbe River. But I didn't change some of the names. I used the names, and this is the short version. I had to wait 50 years to write this book because had I written it years ago, it would have injured some people. And so I hope only good comes out of the book today.
So you've been waiting it out, in other words.
Well, I did. I couldn't write it years ago.
So it takes us back to a little Baptist cemetery in Yoakum, Texas, doesn't it?
Well, that's right. That's where my ancestors are buried. My cousin Weldon is buried there. Hackberry Holland is buried there. My great-grandfather. I didn't change the names.
Mm-hmm.
My great-grandfather, Sam Morgan Holland, whom we meet in a number of books, he's in Cimarron Rose. He was a Confederate soldier. He was a trail drover, and he was also a gunman. He killed 9 people, at least, in gun duels during Reconstruction. But he was also an alcoholic who became a Baptist saddle preacher. He was quite a guy. But I didn't make those stories up or those characters up. I tried to give them maybe a voice they don't have today, but the era I write about in this book, of course, is the post-war era. The first chapter deals with the Dust Bowl and Bonnie and Clyde, and then an encounter that young Weldon at age 16 has with the outlaw couple. And that experience influenced the rest of his life. But the story also deals with Hollywood in the late 40s and the new American empire, oil extraction, which suddenly opened a door to amounts of wealth that were available to anyone with the imagination and boldness to enter what was a very predatory, avaricious environment. But everyone knew it, that it was right there. It was happening then. And for whatever reason, people who were nondescript, we meet some of them. Some of their real names are used, others are fictitious names. But these were people of very humble origins who could hardly read or write, but they knew one thing. There was one thing they could do well, and that was find oil. They had a nose for it. And, buddy, they made tons of money, and they earned it. And I worked in all this. My dad was a pipeliner, a natural gas engineer. My mother worked for an oil company 30 years. I was a landman for Sinclair Oil. I worked a little bit in what's called the Louisiana oil patch, and I was a pipeliner. And so I'm not a critic of the oil industry. What people don't understand is that the grunts on the ground are the bravest people in the world, certainly the bravest and most physically stoic I've ever known. They never complain. And if they were ever afraid, I never saw the instance. But the people who run oil companies are not cut out of the same cloth. The guys topside do business with baseball bats. And anyone who believes otherwise deserves anything that happens to him.
And we certainly experience a lot of this rough business in your new novel, Wayfaring Stranger. You referred to the Golden Age, this period after World War II. And World War II really was the catalyst for this, wasn't it? Because of all the things that happened. And it's a catalyst in your story because your protagonist is in the Ardennes Forest. Mm-hmm. And just one of those miracles of life, he ends up randomly meeting a guy who will become his business partner.
Mm-hmm. That's right. We meet Herschel Pine. He's an infantry sergeant and lieutenant. Weldon Avery Holland finds himself here in the Ardennes Forest with this young soldier from Louisiana, and the two of them end up isolated behind German lines, and they wander into an extermination camp that was just vacated by the SS and discover a woman under a pile of corpses, and they carry her for 5 days through snow. And they end up hiding in a cellar until the 82nd Airborne jumps in on top of them and saves them. But it's a story of a love affair between this young woman, Rosita Lowenstein is her name. She's a great character, just an indomitable woman. And Weldon, she and he marry in Paris and go back to the United States, and Weldon becomes a pipeliner. A man who was an anthropologist, but instead of pursuing a career as an academic, he and his sergeant open a pipeline company and become very wealthy men. But when they do, they discover themselves in an environment that in some ways is as dangerous as the one they thought they left behind in Europe.
I love the story you have in here about the technology that they developed. And I was wondering, is that really something that happened, or did you make that up?
Well, it's a long story, but what we're referring to here is the kinds of wells that were used on pipe back in that era. And these guys innovated a well using German machinery. They bought it as surplus scrap after the war. The two characters, Weldon and Herschel. And up until that time, I guess it was still in the 30s, certainly in the 20s, bolts were used. This gets kind of technical. But these guys innovated a process that allowed them to create wells that would not leak for 100 years. And they had the best, you see, the Germans had the best rolled steel. It was just called German steel. That's why Panzer tanks were almost invulnerable, except maybe from a direct hit from a 105. But the French 75 would bounce off of their sides. It was because not simply of the steel, but the welding process. And these two guys in our book are able to get a hold of these German machines. They remodel them, but they begin to use those machines on American pipelines, what are called joints. See, on a pipeline, on a good day, 200 joints will be welded. I mean, a joint is, oh, I forget. I don't think a lot of people are going to be interested in this. But anyway, that's what they did.
Is that what you did when you talked about laying pipe? Were you welding them?
I was a land surveyor.
Okay.
They're the guys that lay out the right-of-ways. And, well, they do lots of things.
Okay. James Lee Burke joins us. The book is Wayfaring Stranger. And this becomes a story of two couples in a way, because Weldon's partner falls in love with a woman who creates a lot of dramatic tension in this story. And she's the one who connects us with Hollywood.
Yes, we meet a girl named Linda Gale. And Linda Gale marries, she's from Bogalusa, Louisiana, a country girl. She has a high school education and comes from a very poor family, but she has a great deal of initiative. And she more or less stumbles into the world of Hollywood. A fellow photographs her in front of a general store. We're not quite sure if the photographer was sent there for pernicious reasons or not. But anyway, she wanders into Hollywood, but her talent is legitimate. And she becomes a famous movie star. And of course, this was the kind of fantasy that millions of young women had during that era, and they still have it. Hollywood is the secular American cathedral. We denigrate it all, not we, but there are many people who enjoy denigrating Hollywood, sneering at it. The truth is, it is the most creative place on earth, bar none. And it's a collaborative effort comprised of people who are arguably dysfunctional, neurotic, narcissistic, addicted, kicked out of the methadone clinic, refused admission to the French Foreign Legion. And these guys assemble together and produce something like Gone with the Wind. Anyway, and think of it this way. There are only certain things that allow people entrance to sudden wealth and fame. Most people, most of us, work all of our lives to have some security as we reach the sunset of our lives. There are others who seem to just fall through a hole in the dimension. And find themselves in Beverly Hills. And he says, how did this happen? Well, it wasn't just coincidence, but it seems to be. That's it. If we usually examine the person's history, this person, man or woman, has great success in the film industry, it's because the person has a lot of talent and plus initiative, and they all work really hard, eh? My estimation of people in the film industry went way up when I had a couple of experiences working with them, because it's draining. The days are exhausting. and they shoot the same scene six times from six different angles, and it's over 100 degrees. Hmm. It's really uncomfortable, and it's boring and tedious, and sometimes it works. Anyway, you know all that stuff. But
I've never worked with any Hollywood people, Jim, actually. So it's interesting to hear about that.
No, what I mean is that anyone, you know, who thinks through the situation knows these things don't just occur because somebody waves a wand over them, that it's really hard work. Most of this stuff is hard work. Well, you know, as a news person, what it takes to be a successful politician.
Mm.
And it's that reason most of us don't want to be politicians. It's boring. They eat lunch every day with different civic clubs. They sit for hours and hours at meetings that go absolutely nowhere. But there's something bigger they want out of it, and they'll do anything to get it. But most of us don't want to pay that price. Mm. Well, Hollywood works the same way. Most of it's tedious. A lot of it is kind of gilded and jaded. A lot of it's meretricious in nature. And it's fun to be around for a while, but most of the time, average people like ourselves, I mean, who are family-oriented, who really don't want a lot of doodah in our lives, say, it's time to get out of town.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really think I'd like to go back to, I don't know, Baton Rouge or wherever it is, Omaha.
Uh-huh.
I want to see the folks. Faulkner used to do that. He'd just drive off and say, I'm going home. And I think he worked for Hal Roach. And Roach would say, okay, we'll see you later, Bill, thinking he'd see Faulkner in the morning. When Faulkner said he was going home, he meant he was driving straight back to Oxford. And he did it. He would just go all the way back to Mississippi. Just somebody would look around, see, where's Bill? You know, I have to go look for him.
Get me out of Hollywood.
That's it.
Yeah.
But we meet great characters in the book. We meet Benny Siegel and Virginia Hill, the opening of the Shamrock Hotel in 1947. He was there. And we meet some guys who from the oil industry who are very disturbing people who had ties with the mafia. You see, what many people don't understand is that the issue of that time was the oil depletion allowance. It was also the issue when John Kennedy was elected in 1960. The biggest tax swindle in history is the oil depletion allowance. This, I think it was created in 1917. It allowed a 27.5% discount in income taxes paid by oil companies. And when John Kennedy went into office in 62, he announced, 1962, he was going to get rid of it. He was dead 1 year later.
Of course, there's no connection, Jim.
Well,
no connection.
If anyone's interested, they could Google the statement that, I don't know, maybe we're getting into another area, but let's just leave that out.
Yeah.
But this was, you see, that is an issue that is never discussed when people talk about conspiracies and the death of President Kennedy. The discussion always goes to people who are marginal, who actually had no motivation for murdering the president. Look, anyone who knows anything about the mafia knows that mafia does not draw attention to itself. The guys who do that end up dead.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened to Johnny Rosselli and Sam Giancana. They were messing around with the CIA. They were warned not to do it. Johnny Rosselli lived not far from us in Fort Lauderdale. He went to get a package of cigarettes. He was going to walk to the store. The next time anyone saw him, he was in an oil barrel with both of his legs cut off, an ice pick stuck in his stomach, and floating in Biscayne Bay. Giancana was killed about the same time, just before he was to appear before Congress to testify regarding his involvement in the plot to kill Fidel Castro. But that's the way the mob dealt with guys who got involved in embarrassing situations. They always posed as family men. They would live in the suburbs and draw no attention. Gotti was another one. He broke all the rules.
Well, didn't Giancana and JFK have something in common in a woman named Judith Exner?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole story in itself. Well, Jim, we digress. You alluded to these bad guys in the oil industry. And, of course, the fact that these gentlemen, your protagonists, have developed this technology that is so much better than what anyone else is using, that makes everyone in the oil business interested and desirous mm-hmm. of somehow getting their mm-hmm. clutches on this
yeah.
device.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, that's it. These guys, these two men in the book, Weldon Holland and Herschel Pine, his infantry sergeant, developed this process. Actually, they emulate one that was used by the Germans in the construction of the Panzer tank. And they apply those machines to this. They improve. What they do is take what is a technology used successful in the war industries of World War II and apply it to a civilian trade. I mean, actually, that occurred pervasively all through the Western world. I mean, that's the odd byproduct of war, that and there are forms of ingenuity that suddenly take place when we start killing one another and then find later that these can be used for peaceful things.
Right.
And that's what happens with these two men. But you're correct. What these oil companies want is control, not necessarily the technology. They want to control the technology. Okay, it leads us to something else that people don't understand about the oil business. And this was explained to me many years ago by an oil man who knew something about our international connections with people like the Saudis and the Iraqis and the Iranians. He said, the issue is not productivity or even extraction. There are enormous amounts of untapped oil in the world. The issue is the spigot.
Mm.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Be able to turn it on and off or set it at any place on the dial they wish.
Mm.
Because this is what allows stability in the oil market. Instability among the Atlantic community of nations, which are almost entirely dependent upon Mideastern oil. We're not.
Mm-hmm.
We're one of the few countries that could do without it. I think only 7% of our oil comes out of the Persian Gulf. Our greatest importer is Canada.
Uh-huh.
And we get oil from Mexico and from Venezuela, but we could be totally self-sufficient with, you know, a little modification here and there.
A little nudge on the spigot.
But that's not the issue.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is controlling overseas sales. The pipeline coming from Alberta that just both Democrats and Republicans seem to be totally in support of. They talk about jobs and is all doodah.
Uh-huh.
It has nothing to do with domesticity. It has everything to do with overseas sales. That oil is going to be refined in the Texas City area and be shipped overseas. It's not going to American filling stations.
So the Canadians want to export it by sending it through us.
Correct.
Gotcha.
It would also be refined here.
Gotcha. James Lee Burke joins us. His new novel is Wayfaring Stranger. For those of us who have read a lot of your work, we know how steeped you are in the classics. Anyone who reads the Dave Robichaux books knows that Don Quixote is somewhere out there. These guys are such great friends, and they're always tilting at windmills. And in this new novel, you hearken back to the Song of Roland.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, and I kind of led our discussion, and I didn't mean to, into all these things about technology and the oil business. The story's not about the oil business. It's not about it at all. I mean, these men happen to work in it. And because it's deadly stuff and it's boring, ultimately, I think we're destroying, it's my personal opinion, we're destroying the planet. We're denuding it. We're poisoning both our air and our water. But there's some of these elements in the book, but the story is really about the people who live in the times that we do. And as you indicated, it's not only a love story and a story about Hollywood, it harkens back to the age of chivalry. And part of the story is Arthurian. It comes from Thomas Mowry's L'Amour d'Arthur. It also comes from the great medieval poem, The Song of Roland, about the battle between Charlemagne's troops in the Pyrenees and what in the poem are Moslems. In reality, the battle was fought against Basque, but who cares?
Right.
It's a great story. But it is a wonderful account about human courage. And Weldon is fascinated with the story of Roland and the Knights Templar. And when he was recuperating from his wounds in an army hospital in southern France in 1944-45, that he looks upon out on these hills that are golden in the sunset, and there's a Knights Templar castle, or the ruins of the castle. And he can almost see these fellows in armor. Their armor, it looks like melted gold in the sunset. But he's obsessed with this vision of the knight errant who doesn't compromise his principles. And that's what the book is about. The oil industry is a minor factor. People have to choose as they progress through life between good and evil. That's what the book is about. And Linda Gale Pine, Herschel's wife, is, I think, one of the best women characters I've written about. And Rosita is just a great woman, I think. It, actually, I think those two women are the strongest characters in the book. And Bonnie Parker is, too. Bonnie Parker's quite a gal.
Well, Jim, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. My guest has been James Lee Burke. His new novel is Wayfaring Stranger. Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.